Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and in today's episode we're going to be talking to Doug Vakoch, one of the principal people at METI, Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And Doug and some of the METI scientists and some linguists have been working with Noam Chomsky, looking at universal language, this idea that there might be universality in our language which alien civilizations out there in the cosmos might also share, and how that might influence the way that we could potentially contact and talk with alien life. You may remember Doug Vakoch from our previous episode on Star Trek Discovery, and there's no shortage of science fiction references in this conversation. Some of you may be wondering where Maddie is, by the way. She's not disappeared off the planet. She's just doing an awful lot of science and an awful lot of writing as she's finishing off her PhD. She'll be back soon. And we went the other night to do a double bill of the Han Solo movie and Deadpool 2. I highly recommend either of those films or both of them on the same night. Maddie and Steve and Ty will be back here in the shed very soon. But here is Doug Vakoch from METI.
Yes, METI stands for Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And, you know, it sounds a lot like SETI for those who know about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And in fact, it is the opposite process. So rather than listening for signals from advanced civilizations, we transmit powerful intentional signals in an attempt to get a response. We had our first transmission project in October of 2017 as part of a broader project called SONAR, calling GJ273b. That was the name of a star about 12 light years from Earth that we transmitted in celebration of the 25th anniversary of the Sonar Music Festival in Spain. This was an initiative launched by the Sonar community itself, and they asked us to create a tutorial. So, you know, SETI has been searching for extraterrestrials for over 50 years now, but as we get all the more serious about transmitting messages of our own, we need to step back and say what kind of messages would make sense to an alien. And so that is something that we're always pondering, and has launched a new effort to take a look at one of the most prototypical ways we use to communicate with one another here on Earth, language.
Understanding of it, and I think everybody's understanding of it, has always been that maths and science would be the universal language that with which we might be able to communicate with aliens. But this is suggesting something else, right?
Well, that's right. And why do we assume that the aliens have to know maths and science? Well, it's because what do we have in common in order to make contact? If they can receive our radio signals, that means they're good engineers. They've created a radio receiver. So it seems like you need to know something as fundamental as, say, 2 + 2 = 4. And so the usual approach has been to build step by step from basic mathematics to a description of what we and the extraterrestrial scientists have in common, the physical universe itself. So we talk about the periodic table of elements. We talk about laws of physics. But we never think of sending them a message in English or Chinese or Swahili, because certainly that is unique to our own world. Or is it? And that's the question that we're raising at a meeting held in conjunction with the International Space Development Conference. And it's a day-long workshop called Language in the Cosmos, and we're stepping back and asking this question: is there something about language that we would expect extraterrestrials to understand? Do you have to, for example, have language in order to have a society that lets you build those radio telescopes? And we're getting some intriguing suggestions that, you know, maybe there are elements of language that the extraterrestrials would know as well.
Human languages seem quite different to me. I mean, if I think of Chinese or Japanese or Russian and English, and Portuguese, I mean, they all seem quite different. So what is it that is universal across them that we might also find in the languages of any potential aliens?
I think it is exactly those differences between languages, the differences between French and Russian and Swahili and Arabic, that make us say, certainly, the extraterrestrials won't have anything like that. And that remains the belief, that the particular idiosyncrasies of the individual languages are going to vary in extraterrestrial languages the same way that we do here. And so, you know, some of the messages, at least symbolic messages that have been sent out in interstellar transmissions in the past have included a bunch of tweets. You know, so just send them a text message. And the idea has always been that probably won't make much sense. I mean, maybe you'll be able to tell based on how often certain letters repeat how complicated our languages are, but certainly you won't understand what we're getting at. Mm. And that holds true with this new way of looking at language as well. And I say new way, new when it's applied to the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. But these core ideas of what is it then that, if on the surface Russian and French look so different, what is it that they have in common? Well, those languages all talk about things in the world. So there are nouns. They talk about actions. So, you know, we talk about the dog chases the cat. We have one noun, the subject of a sentence, doing some action with respect to an object of that action, of the cat. But the languages we have take radically different forms. So in some languages, you need to keep a very precise ordering of the different words to show what's the subject, what's the verb, and what's the object. Other languages indicate that by changing the endings on the words, that you can shift them around really into any order. So we talk about languages that are very highly inflected, languages like Russian or Greek or Latin, where you convey a lot of information by variations in the individual words, as opposed to Chinese, where the syntax, the sentence structure is really quite straightforward, but the complexity lies in the individual characters. So the thing that we're looking for, and this is really due to a linguist named Noam Chomsky, is what are the underlying characteristics that all languages need to have, even though those outward manifestations are going to be very different. So you need to be able to combine different elements of meaning together. So that's one of the things that you would expect even in an extraterrestrial language. So again, it's not as if all of a sudden we have a universal translator, we get some extraterrestrial language coming in and we can have an automatic translation into English. But as we look at what you need to have a language at all here on Earth, we may get some clues about how extraterrestrials will also structure their world. You know, at the end of the day, Klingon, the invented language used in Star Trek, has a lot more in common with English or French than it will ever have in common with a real alien language. But, you know, the process of constructing languages here on Earth for cinematic purposes actually gives us insights into how we go about constructing languages and how they're all ultimately tied to our particular physical embodiment. You know, we have Klingon sounds like a lot of other languages here on Earth because it has to be spoken by the same the actors who have the same vocal apparatus that's used to generate all other languages. We wouldn't expect that an extraterrestrial would have a vocal tract just like ours. They might not communicate through acoustical means at all, but they still might have an underlying language.
Yeah, okay, because you've got somebody speaking at the conference on Saturday who invented the Dothraki language from the Game of Thrones, haven't you?
That's right. So this is David Peterson. He has invented, I think, 5 or 6 languages. So this is from the Game of Thrones, the Dothraki language. And so he is talking about this process of creating a language and you know, when we create a language for use in films or television programs here on Earth, one of the things that we think about is, what do we want this to convey about the nature of the culture that speaks that language? So, you know, Klingon was designed to be sort of the language of a warrior race. Well, the prototype of that, at least for the linguist who created that language, is to think of some very kind of guttural sounds, very strong sounds. And so similarly with other languages that are created, we want to capture a sense of what that conveys about the nature of the civilization. It is similar when the linguist Paul Frommer created the language for Avatar, for the people of the planet Pandora. Mm-hmm. He did it first by talking with the creator of that film and said, what do you want to convey about the nature of this civilization?
The one that I always go back to is Close Encounters, obviously, and that kind of communicating through sound and vision, music, effectively. Personally, I feel like music is probably something which is universal. It feels like it should be. Birds sing, whales sing, people sing. I feel like that is something that might be out there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do. I think it ties into this original idea that maybe the extraterrestrials will know some math and science. So just because we say perhaps they have a language, it doesn't mean we should write off what they need to know in order to make sense of the universe. And the nice thing is, if you can communicate some simple principles of mathematics and physics, that now gives you a language to start talking about and describing our music. Because if you think about it, fundamentally, music can be described in the language of physics. Each tone has a certain frequency. There's a certain harmonic relationship, a certain ratio of frequencies between different notes in a chord. Each of those tones lasts a certain duration. And so certainly you can't reduce music to math and physics, but you can use math and physics to help communicate the basic vocabulary of music. And then that, I think, now becomes an opportunity to express something about what it is that's distinctively human, or whatever the extraterrestrial culture is. Because, mm-hmm. you know, ultimately, if the only thing we do is tell them that, you know, we know a lot about chemistry and so do you, then what's the point about this whole enterprise? So we do want to say something distinctive about each civilization. The challenge is finding enough common ground to be able to understand one another.
Do you have a hope for Saturday? What's going to happen? Do you have an expected or hoped for outcome?
I do. The outcome is to really step back and say, what are all of the possibilities for communicating with extraterrestrials? Because you know, I think over the last 50 plus years, it's been an abstract question. But given METI's commitment to continue transmitting, we need to get concrete. So when we sent our last messages, that was informed by discussions that we held at the International Space Development Conference, so the same conference, but held 2 years ago, when in fact our the chair of our workshop this week, Sherry Wells Jensen, who is a linguist who's now on the board of directors of METI, she raised this interesting question, saying, you know, a lot of the past messages have assumed or that extraterrestrials will have vision. So there are a lot of pictures, you know, over 100 photographs included on the Voyager interstellar recording. But what happens if the aliens are blind? What happens if they evolved on a world in which the environment is so cloudy and murky that vision really isn't very helpful? How would we communicate with a species like that? So when we sent our transmissions in October of 2017, we said, let's assume the aliens can't see images. How now do we communicate something about the essentials of the radio waves themselves through some simple arithmetic and a description of time and frequency? And so my hope for our meeting this week is to give us some additional ideas of how to create messages moving forward. So our strategy is to for creating interstellar messages is to avoid thinking that we've got the final best solution, because we're not in a position to do that. It's much more effective at this stage, we feel, to create a variety of different messages, each with a different starting point. So my hope is that within the next couple of years, we will be transmitting messages that are inspired by the idea that aliens too may have a language, and perhaps we can communicate some of the underlying structures that their languages and our languages are likely to have in common.
Yeah. When do you hope to hear from them?
Well, this, I think, is the greatest obstacle, the greatest challenge that we face, because in the case of our first transmission to Leuten's star, which is one of the nearest stars to Earth, in fact, we chose it because this is a star that was the closest star that could be targeted from the transmitter in northern Norway that we used, and it is a mere 12 light years away. Which is a very short distance in terms of the size of our galaxy. You know, 100,000 light years it takes, 100,000 years it takes light to travel from one end of the galaxy to the other. But it takes 12 years for a message to get to that star and another 12 for a response to get back. And that's one of the closest stars. So, you know, the only way that experiment works of pinging our nearest neighbor and getting reply back is if the entire universe is chock full of intelligent life. I think a more realistic assumption is we may need to target hundreds or thousands or maybe even millions of stars before we reach one that has an intelligence at the other end that can detect our response and then send us a reply back. And the bad news is that could take timescales of, you know, at least decades, but maybe centuries or millennia. Mm. So this is really a project for the ages. I think that's the biggest challenge that we face, because, you know, at the beginning of the 21st century, humanity is not very good at long-term thinking. We really want immediate results, gratification right now. But for a project like METI, we can't have that. So this is a long-term investment for the future.
Yeah, I'm thinking of things like the James Webb Space Telescope and the various Kepler and TESS and things going to... Will the data that TESS gathers, will that feed into what you're doing? Will you look at those planets that they find and say, okay, let's send a message there?
It will very much so. So the Kepler mission that you mentioned revolutionized the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because it told us that virtually all of the stars, when we go out at night, virtually all of those stars out there have planets around them, and maybe one in five of them has planets at just the right distance from its star that it could support liquid water, which is so important for life on Earth. It's called the habitable zone. And so what we know now is there are a lot of stars out there that have the potential for planets, but we still don't have a good sense of which stars, even in our own neighborhood, in our part of the galaxy, have exoplanets around them, and how many and which ones are in the habitable zone. So that is the Kepler mission was great because it surveyed about 150,000 stars over the course of several years. But most of those stars were quite far, between 500 and 1,500 light years from Earth. They were one patch of the sky. TESS will actually be looking in all directions and focusing on stars that are much closer to Earth. So that will let us give a more accurate survey of our own galactic neighborhood. And then when we combine that with the James Webb telescope, that will have the capabilities to start looking at those recently discovered exoplanets and saying, do they have atmospheres? And if so, do those atmospheres give off the signs of life that we see here on Earth, for example, oxygen and methane? And so the last 20 years of exoplanet hunting have revolutionized the search, because now we know there's a lot of real estate out there that could be inhabited, the next 20 years will be identifying which of those exoplanets does have life. And can we detect a radio signal from them, or are we going to make our first contact with another civilization by seeing indications of microbial life because of changes to the atmosphere of those exoplanets?
But do you have thoughts on the microbial life that might be in the oceans of Europa?
We wouldn't focus on sending a message to Europa because it's really hard to conceive of any life that is in its oceans being sophisticated enough to create a technology to detect our radio signals. Now, it's possible that there could be even slightly more complex life than microbial life, maybe still metazoan life, so somewhat complicated multicellular life. But we wouldn't expect it to be at the level of a human-like intelligence capable of creating technology. But, you know, this prospect of finding life on the oceans of one of the moons in our outer solar system, Saturn or Jupiter, really highlights that there are three ways that we could have first contact with life beyond Earth. It could be right within our solar system itself, where it would primarily be microbial life. No one's holding out hope that this would be intelligent life. So that's the nearest place that we could come to finding life. The downside is there are, you know, maybe 10 or 12 planets or moons within our solar system in which there is currently or previously been liquid water. So that limits the number of options. Plus, in order to get there, we need to send a spacecraft to do the reconnaissance. And so a lot of that depends on the budgets of the world's space agencies. But then the other opportunities for finding life beyond Earth are to detect microbial life in the atmospheres of planets around other stars, or to detect a radio signal. So I would place my bets in the next few years first on detecting radio signals from other stars. We have large-scale projects like the Breakthrough Listen project that'll be looking at a million stars over the next decade. So that's the kind of number that's reasonable to find intelligent life if it's really out there and trying to signal. But then in the next 20 years or so, as we start getting data from TESS and from the James Webb telescope, then I'd shift the odds toward finding microbial life based on the atmospheric signatures of other exoplanets, because the good news is there are a lot of them out there, and so we'll have a lot of places to look. And then my third bet would be finding it within our own solar system as we continue to explore outward.
Well, I'm going to add a bet to that, and that my bet is that on Saturday you're going to have a hell of a conversation.
I agree completely. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to Doug for talking to me, and I have no doubt that those conversations were fascinating. We'll post links on thecosmicshed.com to any output of that, and we'll be back very soon with an episode on something. Oh, I really should say before I go, I've been watching Lost in Space, and we did that episode with Ethan Siegel on Lost in Space, and I just don't think that I was positive enough about it. I think it's wonderful. I love it. So I just wanted to put that right. Lost in Space, utterly wonderful. So pleased to see a second series. We should probably do another episode on it. But for now, thank you very much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.